time to leave the bus. It's the first and only lecture in this mini course with the title of Spot Space Presentation and Replication Analysis of Quantum Functions.
Thank you very much, Bartek. And Francois asked me to give another lecture of a more tutorial character, and it's my pleasure to comply with his request. He actually have a very good chair, but because he contributed a lot to the theory and in the background and the history of this problem, which is Fock-space representation with a focus on perturbation analysis of Poisson functionals. And this is based on a paper of mine which has just appeared in Bernoulli. But actually, I finished working on that topic 2 years ago, so I have a hard time to remember all the details. Again, I'm sorry, the talk is concerned with the Poisson process on a general state space. And sorry also for changing notation. I'm using a capital phi now for a Poisson process. For several reasons, this it had some tradition, as Francois knows. And in particular, in these areas, people are more used to the phi than to the eta. And anyway, that's what is being used in the paper. But otherwise, the definition is exactly the same. And also, the notation for the intensity measure, lambda, is exactly the same. And as it is a tutorial, please feel free to interrupt me. Really, whenever there is a little question, you know, I would not like to lose you at the very beginning. So the phi is a Poisson process, is a fascinating random object, one of the two basic objects in probability theory, Brownian motion and Poisson process. And one of the nice things you can do with Poisson processes is you can define them in any space. Once you give me a sigma finite measure, I can return a Poisson process, at least in principle. Now, I'm a little bit worried, because now I have to explain the subject of perturbation analysis. But there are people in the audience who can do so much better. And please, Francois, for instance, correct me if I get something wrong here. Suppose you have your intensity measure, pointer is not working, I'm sorry. You have a intensity, no worries, we can survive without pointer. You have the intensity measure depending on a parameter. But somebody, oh. Okay, never mind. Your intensity measure depends on a real parameter, theta. For instance, theta could just be a multiple of an underlying intensity measure, which is given as the product of Lebesgue measure and some distribution Q on some Marx space Y. Think of the Boolean model, or think in the case D equal to 1 of a compound Poisson process, for instance. Thank you very much, Daniel. And what do I have to do? Where's the where's the pointer?
Forwards, backwards, pointer.
Pointer. Ah, I see. Yeah, here we go. Thanks to Daniel. We have a pointer. This Poisson process is in general a complicated object, and even more so if you apply nonlinear functionals. And as we know, it can be quite painful and in most cases actually impossible to get real exact distributional results. So one might think, okay, I have my function f of phi, and for some reason I interpret it as a cost function or something. I would like somehow to optimize it, at least in the expected value. But there's an underlying parameter, so I have the freedom to play with an underlying parameter. In this talk, this is always one-dimensional. You can extend this. I will have to say at the end of the... I can say something at the end of the talk. Now, if you would like to a gradient method to get the minimum or the maximum, depending on the behavior of f, one might try to do simulations of your process for many theta, take the difference quotient and take the derivative. It's a painful process. So maybe it's good to get a closed form expression for a derivative, depending on a fixed parameter then, and then to use Monte Carlo integration to estimate the derivative. There is a whole book written on this topic, not only on that, by Peter Glynn and Søren Asmus, the other way around. But as I said, there are real great experts in the audience who can tell you more about that. So that's one motivation of perturbation analysis. And I will get back to my way of interpreting perturbation analysis of Poisson processes later. But first of all, I would like to take some time to explain the mathematical background. Because there are two ingredients in this theory which are being used in my paper. The first one is what I called, or other people called, Fock-space representation of Poisson functionals. And so let's explain this first. So the Fock space is I take it in an abstract way. Fock was a physicist, and the Fock space is just a direct sum of Hilbert spaces, all coming from the same measure. So lambda is the intensity measure, yet, but for the moment you can even forget about this. Lambda is a measure on the underlying space, for instance, Rd times Mach space. Lambda n is the nth fold product of lambda, which it is itself. It's a measure on x state space to the power of n, and I look at the L2 space. That's a Hilbert space with the usual scalar product notated in this way. And if I sum up all the scalar products, I get a Hilbert space, at least if I take only functions f, sequences of function fn and gn, such that if I put fn equal to gn, that the whole series converges. That's standard basic functional analysis to prove that this is a Hilbert space. It's the direct sum of all these Hilbert spaces, and actually I restrict myself to symmetric functions. It's enough. Okay. So what got this Hilbert space to do with our Poisson process? Okay, so the lambda is just the intensity measure of a Poisson process. And let's try to make a connection between this Fock space and our Poisson process. And the way to do it is to use the difference operators. So that's just the same notation as in the morning and yesterday, and now is the question. For convenience.
The others, HN, could be any Hilbert space.
No. Good point. No. It's the lambda, the Fock space depends on lambda. So it's the intensity measure. Okay. But no, never mind. The intensity measure is given. So the intensity measure, or the measure, gives you a whole sequence of Hilbert spaces. So square integrable functions on x, square integrable symmetric functions of two variables, square integrable symmetric function of three variables, and so on. So it's a whole hierarchy. So the space, the spaces are called Hn, okay? And I take the direct sum, and it's just convenient to use this normalization. Thank you for the question. So there's nothing, once lambda is fixed, there's nothing arbitrary here anymore. Then the Fock space depends on it. Okay, so this was this is a brief reminder of the difference operators, and that's really the same notation as in the morning. If I take the difference operators of order n, then they depend on x1 up to xn, so it's some sort of iterated differential derivative, directional derivative. If I plug in the Poisson process, I get a random variable, I take the expectation, and it gives me really an element of this Hn. This is now a symmetric square integrable function of x1 up to xn. And it turns out that if you would like to compute the scalar product of two square integrable functions of the underlying Poisson process, then we can do it in probably at first glance more complicated way. Namely, we can write down an infinite series. And what you can see here is, first of all, that's the scalar product in the Fock space, because it's just the infinite series of all the scalar products. But the ingredients are explicitly given, namely Tn of f is the expected nth order difference operator. So if you would like to use a more abstract language, we can associate now with any f an element of the Fock space, namely the whole sequence of expected difference operators. And with g we do the same. And this theorem is then saying, okay, first of all, we have something in the Fock space, because if you put f equal to g, then you have here something finite, because we are in L2. So the whole series converges. So the whole series converges absolutely. And moreover, we have this isometry relationship. And that's the first ingredient for the perturbation analysis we are going to do in the next half an hour, if I survive. And that's all what we need, actually. But of course, you all know that we can go back. So if you give me an element of the Fock space, then I can use this marvelous Wiener E2 integral to go back. But we don't need this here. So that's why, for me at least, the Fock space representation, as I call it, is more fundamental than the Wiener Ito chaos expansion. And to convince you even more, and because it's a tutorial, I give you the argument, which is not too difficult. And it was scattered, it's based on my paper with Matthew. It was scattered in the literature. Actually, you have just, what you had to do is to put known things together. Well, we would like to prove this Fock space representation, and the standard thing to do also in the Gaussian world is to take such exponential functionals. So I have to explain the notation. Mu is now a counting measure. So that's it's a dangerous word now. It's a potential realization of a Poisson process, okay? And so it's a configuration. And mu of v is my notation for integral. So mu of v is the integral of a certain test function with certain properties, d mu. And this is actually only just a sum. If mu is of this form. So I just take my function and take the values at the different atoms of the underlying counting measures and adding up. Okay? Now, if you take such a test function, it's now a function of mu. E to the minus, this guy, is a function of mu. And we assume that mu vanishes outside a set of bounded. So it's somehow supported by a set of finite intensity measure. Now everybody knows, if we plug in here the Poisson process, and if we take the expectation, and the expectation is the first summand in the Fock space representation, okay, then we have what we call Laplace functional or characteristic functional, and there are other words for this, of a Poisson process. So maybe I write this down from the top of my head, because we are going to use it. So if I have some non-negative function now, and these V's are also assumed to be non-negative, but otherwise no assumption, then this is equal to e to the minus, and then I have the integral of 1 minus e to the minus V d lambda, which is, by the way, easy to prove, and people call this different way. You can even call this the Levi-Chinchin representation of the characteristic function of a Poisson process, as you wish. Okay, so this gives you the expectation. What about the difference operators? That's easy, fortunately, because take the first difference operator. What happens? It's a tutorial, so we can take some time. So what is our functional now is dx e to the minus mu of v. Now what does it mean? It means I have to add to my configuration mu a point at x and form the integral. And I have to subtract the original thing. But I've just recalled what the integration with respect to a counting measure is. First of all, the integration with respect to a sum is the sum of the integration, and the integration of v with respect to delta x is v of x. Which means that this e to the minus mu of v, let's write immediately here v of x, minus e to the minus. So you can pull out e to the minus mu of v, and you get a factor which is dependent on x, then, which is e to the minus v of x minus 1. And of course you can iterate this, because the x is here, the mu is here. You can iterate this n times. So it's very, very easy to write down the difference operators. And then again, we are using this characteristic functional for our Poisson process, and we are ending up with this formula, namely for this special choice of f, the nth order difference operator is given in this way, which looks very similar to Giovanni would have to say much more about that than in the Gaussian world. There are many similarities. There are many similarities between the Poisson and the Gaussian world, but at some stage it splits. Okay. So we keep this formula in mind, and we would like to prove the Fock-space representation. So on the left-hand side, we have the scalar product of f and g, and we are still focusing on the special situation where f of eta is e to the minus eta v, and g of eta is e to the minus eta w. So this is this, isn't it? So this is again the Laplace transform of the function v plus v, so I have this formula. That's the left-hand side. But now I can compute the right-hand side because I have my formulas for T and F. And the Fock-space representation is telling me what I have to do is I have to take the scalar product of these two guys and to sum up, taking into account the combinatorial factors. So let's do this. So this is happening here. These are the prefactors, and then you see I have this function. That's, this iteration gives me tensor product of these functions. But I have to integrate with respect to lambda n, your question. Hn is the integration with respect to lambda n. But this is Fubini, isn't it? So this is the product of such an integral with respect to lambda to the power of n. And if I put things here together, I see, oh, it's just the same. So for special functions f and g, it's really an easy exercise, a good exercise if it comes to teaching about Poisson processes, as it's an application of the formula for the characteristic function. And that's already the main step, up to some technicalities. Namely, now we take all linear combinations of such functions. In this way, we get also negative functions and so on. And one can prove this is dense in L2. And once we know this, one has to be a little bit careful, but it's not too difficult to use Hilbert space and completeness arguments. We don't need any assumptions on the state space in order to apply completeness assumptions. A measure space, the L2 space is always complete. No problem about that. So we can then use Hilbert space arguments to extend the result to general square integrable functions. So this was the proof, basically, of the Fock space representation. Okay. Now, I mentioned already twice, there is a second ingredient for this theory. And this is absolute continuity of distributions. So I should dwell on this a little bit. First of all, some notation which people find convenient in this area. Whenever I have a potential intensity measure, lambda, on our underlying state space X, I denote by P sub lambda a probability measure on our abstract space, which could be, for instance, the space of point configuration. But you soon realize it's not always a good idea to take this space when it comes to additional randomness, random shifts, Brownian motions are all over the place, so it might be better to take P lambda as a measure, a probability measure, or on some abstract space. But we assume then that this phi, this fixed mapping, if you like, from omega to the space of configuration, is a Poisson process under this measure with this intensity measure. So it's quite convenient. Now, take two finite, at all what I'm now going to tell you is very, very, very classical. It's really a tutorial. If you take two finite measures, finite intensity measures, nu and rho, with the property that if a set is a rho null set, then it should be a nu null set. So nu is absolutely continuous with rho, so there is a rather negative derivative of nu with respect to rho. Then this absolute continuity transfers to the point process distributions. So the point process distribution, the Poisson distribution with this intensity measure is absolutely continuous with respect to the distribution with this intensity measure, and the likelihood, that's why I write here L, and now it's phi. In the previous slides it was mu, never mind. Okay. The likelihood function is given in an explicit way, and we all know this. Maybe you would like to write this, take the logarithm here, then you get the sum, and you see this is e to the integral of the logarithm of this function h with respect to phi, and you see no need to define a support of this counting measure. It's just an integral of the logarithm of this function h. How to prove this? It's again an easy exercise in probability theory. It's again elementary. You just write down the Poisson expectation as Poissonized sum of binomial distributions. You have a finite Poisson process looks like follows. You have a Poisson distributed number of points in the space. And once this number of points is fixed, given, then the points are distributed in X with the normalized lambda. So if you break things according to the value of the number of points, and then you use the fact that you have absolutely continuity, and then you put things together, and after three lines, you are done. What is important here is that this likelihood function has a very nice form. A test. Here. It's the underlying. So there is a density, and thanks for asking this question. So you can express the density of the higher level thing of the point process distribution in terms of this density, and it comes up if you do the calculation. So H is essentially up to normalization the density also of the normalized things. Any questions so far? So that's very, very basic. So now what happens in the infinite case? So my aim was to, a couple of years ago, was to understand the behavior of infinite perturbations and possibly infinite sign perturbations, whatever the application might be. I might indicate one, but okay. So what happens in the infinite case? That's more tricky. Obviously, if you have two intensity measures which are sigma finite now, the point process distributions, the Poisson distribution, do not need to be absolutely continuous anymore. In fact, they rarely are. Take two stationary Poisson processes, for instance, of rate 1 and rate 2. They are living in completely orthogonal worlds by the law of large numbers, for instance. Yeah, take the ergodic theory, then the number of points in a set of volume n on a ball of volume n divided by n to the power of t converges to 1 for the one process and the 2 for the other process. Completely different words. Okay, but we know what the answer is. Namely, if we have two absolutely continuous sigma finite measures, then this transfers to the distribution of the Poisson processes if and only if this integrability condition holds. So we have to take the square root of this h you have been asking for, of this density of nu with respect to rho, minus 1, we have to square it, and we have to integrate it with respect to the dominating thing. And this has to be finite. If it is not, then the contrary is true, then the distributions are mutually singular. And again, because it's a tutorial, I try to explain what the reason is. This is the Hellinger distance. Yeah, actually, that is this the point process. I have some references at the end. I'm not an expert on this, but this really there's a whole industry now on Hellinger things, and you can do it in much more general for much more general processes. If you look up a book by Shakur Shayaev. You find a whole chapter or two on Hellinger distances between semi-martingale distributions. But still, in a nutshell, you have this kind of result. And I explain you why this is true. I try to explain. Not sure whether I will succeed, okay? So let's assume for the moment, again, that nu and lambda are finite measures. Then we know that then because we have assumed absolutely continuity, we know we have absolute continuity of the point process distribution, and the L is of a very explicit form. It's prefactor times e to the integral of ln. Now, if you take the square root of this thing, maybe you think of the product, it's better. You have basically the same thing. You have to take the expectation of the product of a test. Yeah, I hope you see it here. Take the square root of this. Then you have the square root here, okay? And it's a Poisson process. So you can apply a version of your characteristic function for products, and you can compute. Oh, it's just this. The three-line calculation. It's this. So the expectation of the square root of this thing is e to the minus 1/2 integral of square root of h minus 1 squared d rho. Fine. Now, the measures are assumed to be sigma finite. So there is a partition of the space into sets Cn where both nu and rho are finite measures. Of course, the restrictions are then also absolutely continuous, so I have this absolute continuity relation on any of the Cn. And I have this relation, as I have shown you before. Okay? So, but Poisson process, if we choose the Cn disjoint, measurable partition, Poisson process on different sets are disjoint. And there's something extremely classical, which is Kakutani's dichotomy. Saying if I have absolutely continuity for, if I take a sequence of independent random variables and I have absolutely continuity, if I have two sequences of independent random variables and you have absolutely continuity in any coordinate, then either the whole sequences are absolutely continuous with respect to each other, or they are completely orthogonal. And the condition is exactly, there are several ways to write it, but one way to write it is this. If you look up the book or Wikipedia, Kakutani should show you, I didn't try. we have absolutely continuity if these, or if the product of this expectation is positive. So you have to buy this, okay? If you buy this, then we can go back to this thing here. We take the product of this. So product of exponentials is exponentials of the sum. Cn's are mutually disjoint. So what I have here is e to the minus integral over the whole space of this square. And they should be positive. With other words, this integral has to diagonally converge. Okay, so this was the second ingredient. We have more to say because Martingale theory, for instance, gives you that this likelihood function in the absolutely continuous case is really a limit of the likelihood function for unbounded CNs. Okay. And later on, we need not this condition, but a stronger one. And we need this because we would like to have the square of the likelihood function to be integrable. And one can check using the same recipe as before that this happens if this integral is finite. I will get back to this. Okay, now perturbation analysis. So the motivation at the beginning was, okay, I have some dependence on theta and I would like to understand what's the behavior of the expectation of a functional as a function of this underlying parameter. Obviously, the more general point of view is the following. I have here, I start with an intensity measure lambda, and this is a preliminary version of the general result to give you some motivation. I start with an intensity measure lambda, and I'm adding, for instance, some finite perturbation. So, for instance, I have Lebesgue measure, and we are using this at the moment in some other things. So I have Lebesgue measure, and I'm adding a multiple of Lebesgue measure on a fixed ball. So I perturb the original Lebesgue measure in this way. Now, a direct computation, basically going back to Ilya Mochanov and Sergei Suyev, and this is really a seminal paper, I will get back to this later, they have treated this sort of problems for finite intensity measures. Never mind, you can use basically the same calculation for general sigma finite measures lambda and on the more general integrability conditions to come up with such a result, namely the expectation of our functional, which is sort of given, okay, under the perturbed measure is the original expectation, and then I have some Taylor series expansion because mu is just the difference between the new and the old measure, and here we see our old friends, namely the expected difference operators of order n with respect to the original intensity measure. This result can be proved really elementary, and I've done this in the paper just to motivate the main result, which is this one. Okay. And we have to spend some time to discuss this. So now we consider a rather general situation. We have two sigma finite measures, lambda and nu, on x, and there's always another sigma finite measure dominating the two guys here, for instance, the sum. I take I fix one dominating measure for lambda and nu. Hence, there is a density of lambda with respect to rho, which is denoted h lambda, and there is a density of nu with respect to rho, which is denoted h nu. And I'm assuming that these integrals both are finite. And I hope you remember now, this is guaranteeing this condition. So it's not the square root, it's not the Hellinger thing. It's a stronger assumption. Then, if the function f is square integrable under the dominating thing here, then I have again the same formula. Namely, I'm moving from lambda to a new measure nu. Okay? So the idea is now, you can also call it, maybe it's better to call it variational analysis. I think Sergei and Ilya, they prefer to call it variational analysis of Poisson function, as you wish. So you have one intensity measure lambda, and you move to another one. Nu. This can happen now. So first of all, nu and lambda are sigma finite. But we have to have this integrability assumption, and you know somehow where it comes from absolute continuity. But on the way from lambda to nu, several things can happen. At principle two, I can remove mass, I can subtract mass, and I can add mass somewhere else. So everything is allowed. The perturbation can be negative. Or what I assume is that the perturbed thing, the new, is again a measure. But otherwise, the formula looks exactly the same. And I give you the idea of the proof. Very, very briefly, no? Because then you can see how the two ingredients I started with enter the scene. And then we can discuss special cases. So what is the right-hand side of the assertion? We would like to prove this variational formula, power series expansion or whatever you would like to call it. So let's look at the right-hand side here.
So I'm sorry, the difference between this and Molchan of Zuyev is that mu minus lambda is a sine measure, whereas in the other one...
Yeah, more difference. Also, first of all, it's a sine measure, that's also, but these measures are sigma finite, which is a subtle point. I'm not sure whether I will have the energy at the end to tell you something about Levy processes, but I have examples in Levy processes where you, these results apply, but the perturbation is really infinite. And so you can't apply the Molchanov-Zuyev result. Actually, you have asked me the question now. The focus of the Molchanov-Zuyev paper is really on the applications, on real applications, in stochastic optimization, for instance. And because I'm not sure whether I will have the time, let's do it right now. because there are some people here who contributed to this theory. So, I mean, you haven't seen yet the derivative formulas, but I can tell you that some of the stuff can be done in more, much more general stationary settings. So Francois, together with Sergei and Maurice Klein, whom I met once, have written a nice paper on the perturbation analysis of functions of more general random measures. Okay, Bartek, very nice paper, has shown how to expand expectations of general point processes on the line, I think, or on the half line, in terms of factorial moment measures for general point processes. But he requires then strong continuity sort of assumptions on the function f, because for a general point process, what do you have? We have the factorial moment measures, we have pi measures, okay, but we don't have all the tools available for the Poisson process. Brown was the one who wrote the seminal paper, and that was another, that's another paper maybe, on the discrimination of Poisson process. That's just the argument I tried to explain about absolutely continuity. Mark Brown, 71. Laurent Descrosses-Fong came up with derivative formulas for Levy processes, so this is a very important piece of work, in my opinion. That's the Fox space representation. Okay. But here, I would like to point out this, and Giovanni, I took the freedom to add this. Just it just came to me yesterday late, and I couldn't sleep anyway. So this is really a beautiful paper by Ilya and Sergei. So to prove the formula in their case, if you have finite Poisson process, it's not a big deal. But yeah, to apply them is very, very interesting. And they write a chapter in this book here, which is going to appear next year. And it was Bartek who asked me, is there some book around summarizing all the developments? I think Giovanni and Matthias Reitzner, who is the other editor, do all what they can to cover some of the exciting developments. I have a chapter, thank you.
First one.
Okay. But there is a chapter also on this variational calculus. And maybe I can make my life easier by saying, please go to this chapter. It's already available, by the way, I've seen on the web. Also yesterday. Please go to this chapter, preliminary version, and check out what sort of applications they have for finite Poisson processes. Okay. Sorry?
Buy the book.
And, okay.
see the primitive version then, but
yes.
Buy the book. Okay. So I wanted to indicate the proof of this general Taylor series expansion, at least briefly. So it's a very natural thing, and it's the formulation is completely symmetric. So the conditions are symmetric in lambda and nu, and it's a rather weak integrability assumption. There's no continuity assumption at all. It's just square integrability with respect to a certain measure. And then we have this formula. And by the way, if you take here, you might ask how to define this thing here. What is it? It's a signed measure. Actually, it's more general than a signed measure because it's a difference of two sigma finite measures. How to define it? Okay. People in doing measure theory all the time know how to do it. Nu and lambda have densities with respect to a dominating measure. Take rho, for instance. And then you just take here the difference of the density, difference of the densities to the n-fold tensor product and integrate with respect to the dominating measure. That's what we do. And then absolutely continuity means really if you take the if you take here the absolute values, you have something convergent. So everything is okay, even if this is negative, and it might be negative. The only thing we assume here is that both nu and lambda are measures, and of course this fundamental integrability assumption. Okay, the first step in the proof is to go, it's a pretty much a black box calculation, and then you have to come up with some continuity arguments. So the black box calculation is the following. The first thing you can do is you replace the expectation here by an expectation with respect to the dominating thing. In return, we get a density here. We have a density there. So that's the same thing. Okay. This pretty much looks like Fock-space representation, doesn't it? The only thing is here, under the assumption I made, this is square integrable. But this guy this was a nuisance for quite some time. I couldn't solve it. If f is square integrable, these difference operators do not need to be square integrable. They're slightly less. So what we assume just for the moment, and I don't tell you how to get the general case, assume f is bounded. If f is bounded, then all difference operators are bounded. This is an L2, this is an L2, and I can apply the Fock-space representation. So what is the Fock-space representation? The Fock-space representation has to do the following. I have to take the derivatives of these two guys, of the product of these two guys. But there's a formula for that. So the derivative of the product of these two guys. Okay. And one important thing is the following fact here. If you take the derivative of this likelihood function, you can basically do the same as before. This is of an exponential form. So if I'm adding a point, each time I'm adding a point, I get a factor of this type, which is very good. So you can plug this in, that's basically already the idea. You can plug this in, and then you do your calculation, and in the end, you go back to the other measure, which is nu. Check the paper for more details, but it's certain, it's pretty much a black box calculation, but to extend it from the bounded case to a general square integrable case takes some more efforts, okay, some measure theoretic efforts. I would like to explain a little bit more these conditions here. So, one thing one could do is the following. I have my original measure lambda and have a new measure nu. So I might, and I do, decompose nu according to, I think it's Hahn-Jordan decomposition. Is this the right? I always mix these things up. It's the Hahn-Jordan is the decomposition of nu with respect to lambda. So there's an absolutely continuous part, which I call nu1, with respect to the original measure. And there's a singular part, which I call nu 2. And now I destroy symmetry. So I'm looking, this is now not a, a symmetric formulation. I could now look at the condition. For instance, I could take this rho here as a dominating measure. Yeah? Because this part is already absolutely continuous. If I'm adding lambda, if I'm adding nu tie to, to lambda, I get something which is dominating lambda. I have freedom, by the way. I have freedom to choose the dominating measure rho. And the conditions are now the following. I have to have this stronger, slightly stronger than necessary, probably. I don't know what is necessary. I have to assume that the deviation in this square, in the L2 sense, from 1. The 1 case is the case where just I don't change anything. So if the derivative is 1, then I just keep the odd measure. So the L2 distance of this absolutely continuous part from 1 should be finite. And the singular perturbation should be finite as well. If this is the case, then the formula holds. And you can do the same thing here, and you can actually revert. You can ask yourself the following question, and then I will comment again on the previous slide. You might ask the following question. Suppose I have this variational formula for fixed lambda and u for all bounded f. Bounded f assumes, satisfies the condition, square bounded functions are always square integrable, whatever measure you take. Probability measure. Okay. So assume the variational formula is true for all bounded functions. So assume this is true for all bounded functions. Then I have to have necessarily the following. I can always do something like this. I have I take a disjoint. I take two disjoint sets. Such that lambda and u are equivalent on C1 and orthogonal on C2. And then it follows necessarily this absolutely continuous part has this finite Hellinger distance, if you like, and the other parts on the singular set are finite. And that's the basic message, and actually it's easy to believe from the very beginning, okay? If you would like to have for general functions f without additional information some infinite Taylor expansion, you have to have that the absolutely continuous part, you have to have that the infinite perturbation has to be absolutely continuous. In other words, there has to be some integrability assumption, and the singular perturbation has to be finite. If not, things go wrong for certain functions. This is actually, I don't know. If you ask me whether I can remove here the square root, I don't know. Whether this is really equivalent to the variation for, I don't. My methods fail. Okay, so this is the this is representing 45 minutes. So, okay then. I'm getting more time. Maybe I spend only 5 minutes on derivative formulas. So at the beginning, I tried to motivate the topic by derivatives. This is much less in a sense. So I don't. Maybe I'm not interested in a complete series Taylor type expansion of the new expectation. I just would like to take the derivative. So one simple situation is the following. I take the underlying measure lambda and perturb it by a multiple of some signed measure such that the sum is non-negative, so that this guy makes sense. Okay. If you go into the formula, then you remember this is the increment here. The increment was here, so I can pull out t to the power of n. It's now really a Taylor series in t. And if you take a derivative, you get this here, for any t, which is Margulis-Rousseau type formula. So the derivative of the expectation of this guy is the integral of the expectation of the difference operator. And Margulis Russo type formula, the name comes from the fact that in Bernoulli setting, it was Margulis and later Russo independently, some discussion on that, who discovered this sort of formula for basically for finite Bernoulli random fields. And it's the Poisson analog, if you like. The point here is, what we look at here is a linear perturbation. In practice, it might happen that the perturbations are nonlinear. So let's take a brief look at this situation. There are some assumptions, but it's not too complicated. So let's assume now, again, I have a parameter varying in a set I, and I have a special parameter I'm interested in. I would like to know the derivatives of the expected value at this specific point, theta naught, for some reasons. And I take a function h, and you have to understand what's going on, and you have to look at this here. I perturb, as I go from lambda to a new measure lambda theta, just by adding to 1, which is the density of lambda with respect to lambda, in general, non-linear perturbation of, that's a non-linear function of theta. Okay? So if theta is equal to theta naught, no perturbation at all, but if theta is not equal to theta naught, this might be positive or negative, and this r of theta is some non-linear thing, but it should go to zero in this sense. Actually, that's already a special case considered by Laurent under pretty much the same assumptions in a Levy setting. So I perturb the original measure in a way that the perturbed thing is again absolutely continuous with respect to the lambda. And now if you take now the derivative, you have the same formula as before. And the way to prove it is just to use the general formula for lambda and lambda theta, divide and take the difference, difference and take the derivative. There's nothing better you can do. You can apply this to Levy processes, but I don't dare to start this. I just tell you. A Levy process is a process with independent and homogeneous increments. And let's just do it immediately in RD. There's no difference at all. In RD, the Levy process is the distribution is described by a triplet, as everybody knows. Namely, the covariance matrix of the Brownian part, which is independent of the jump time, the jump part, and by a drift, and by the parameters of the Poisson process governing jump times and jump sizes. Okay. So up to this independent Brownian motion multiplied by some matrix here, we are in business. We are in the Poisson world. But if you freeze the Poisson-Boolean the Brownian motion P of t. If you freeze the Brownian motion P of t, you can apply the previous theorem theory. So it's what we can do is we can consider a second Levy process with the same volatility. We have to take the same volatility because otherwise things are getting mutually singular. And then we can perturb the Levy measure. And we can apply our results. And what is the difference operator doing? Very, very easy. I mean, if I'm adding a point now, I'm adding, in the jump part, I'm adding a time instant where I get a new point and a jump size. So up to this time, the process is the same. And after that, it jumps to the original value plus x. That's all. And if you restrict to a finite time horizon, you can apply the previous theorem, and you find examples of infinite perturbation in my paper, and you find a sort of semi application also in the paper, because of course, I mean, in general, you can't expect the perturbation variation analysis to give you explicit formulas. What you can expect is maybe some handy expressions for a derivative which you can easily simulate. Okay, that's pretty much what I... not all what I wanted to say, but I think I stop here and I'm ready to ask to answer further questions. No.
So, it's a more historical comment. I learned about these techniques in 1985 at Bell Labs. There was a paper by Marty Reimann and Bert Simon who did that for, they called that light traffic.
I know.
For, and that there was a tradition, so they didn't phrase, of course, in this term, but there is an early tradition from King series from the 80s, where they were trying to look at lambda, one of your two measures to be the empty measure, and to compute explicit expansion for the, they call that light traffic, which was for a special case. But they would do that for Jack, but I think Marty's paper was for Jackson, if I remember well. And so there is a tradition from the early 80s to the 90s, where people were trying to compute the light traffic expansion and prove in some cases that there were, converging series in terms of this this DX operator. And that started quite early. And that, I don't know, it would be interesting to check since that's on group project, who really first saw that for the Poisson case, but it was already active in the, 84,
I would say. I might have this in the list of references. I'm familiar with this paper, and Francois is polite enough not to mention his own work, which is much more than the one I mentioned. There is some nice paper on together with Pierre. And so in the Poisson setting, this general thing comprises all these things, light traffic analysis and... I forgot the name you are using. Also, your paper is probably in the list of references, but I think I have included this. This was very important in the beginning.
But who started it? I mean, Simon, I think 84, but they were quoting other papers, so...
you know me. I always try to learn a lot, as much as about the history as I can. In this case, I really don't remember. So I try to pay tribute to all the sources. I'm not sure whether I did full justice. But this was a seminal paper, I remember this. And probably I have seen this already as a PhD student in Peter Franken's seminar. Yeah, you can. Okay. Not quite. I can complete the picture. So that's why also, there are some results maybe in parallel because people are using different languages. So you can look at it in a purely measure theoretical way. That's not the way we like. If you have two measures, nu and lambda, okay, you can always use this decomposition and go to the new measure in two steps. First of all, you just take a dominating measure and you take your derivative and you take the fraction. And then you do a thinning, independent thinning, to get the minus part. And then you are adding independently another Poisson process. You can always represent the perturbed process in this probabilistic way. I don't use this, but you can do it. And this has been done. So you can really see what's going on. You can couple the two processes. You are removing. It's not only adding. It's also removing by sinning. And then you are adding what you need to add. I can't. Maybe for the general theory, I can't. But I use the Poisson processes, Poisson process properties all the time for this power. Okay. But we can discuss this later. No. I'm Daniel is curious. I mean, sorry, Daniel, you have seen this before, of course.
But not the discussion.
Okay. So that's the most general result. This one?
Yes.
Yeah, this is in a sense slightly more general because mu is non-negative. You can even weaken the square integrability even more. This comes out from the calculation, but otherwise it's the same expression. So up to the slight difference in the integrability assumption, this is just a very special case of this. Okay.
But now in this set, imagine that you have eight-point process, an arbitrary point process, which is plays the role of your Poisson of the intensity mu, but instead of Poisson, it's just an arbitrary point process.
You're adding another.
You're adding a Poisson process of intensity lambda.
Yeah.
Then you have exactly the same expression, except that these mu to the power n, these are factorial moment measures,
yeah.
This what is not Poisson point process. And then add one of those operators iterated and transit. So in this sense, we know how to extend it to the case we refer to an arbitrary by adding Poisson. But the problem, how to thin an arbitrary point, how to conclude that this is like...
You can't do this. And moreover, if you add a general point process, you need some more assumptions on the F. No, it's not enough. You are a conversion of the series and some continuity property. I agree up to the point that the formulas are similar and that the integrability assumptions are probably much stronger. You have to pay a price. But we can discuss this later. I'm sorry, but I mean, we have discussed this in the past, I know.
It's a conflict of interest.
No.
I want to see to what extent this can be taken beyond the Poisson
assumption. This is a Poisson, a formula in this formulation. If you would like to extend this, you have to use in your S in your work. You have done it on the line. But there are some paper with Volker Schmidt and others on. Yeah, I know. And I know this was quite a story for some time. You have used the factorial moment measures and the expected difference operator. I know.